some developments, but it's very important to focus on the fact that the footprint of the development and the overall bulk and scale of the development would be unchanged with or without the code change proposal.
Great, thank you. I do not have any further questions, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Maureen, do you have any?
Yes, I do. Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Wetland. How are you?
Thank you.
Good. Thank you for your account of what you've done for this project. And what I'd like to do, I understand one of the things that you mentioned is that you were involved with the prior mandatory housing affordability study, right?
I was.
And was that a DNS or was that a some other SEPA category?
That was a determination of significance.
Okay, so a full study was done on that?
Right. After that determination, the city prepared a complete environmental impact statement.
Okay. And in terms of row houses and townhouse zones, or the LR zones, what was the major or minor changes? Let's say, what was the changes that took place with the MHA with townhouses and row houses?
Well, I think you went through some of this with Mr. Staley, but there were a variety of changes, some affecting allowable floor area ratio, some affecting the height limits, some affected the density limits.
Okay. And do you know how the density levels changed from before MHA time to the after to our current state with townhouses and row houses?
They increased in some cases. In some cases, they generally increased. Without having the numbers in front of me, I don't want to try to say off the top of my head those specific increases.
I think it's the current state was in the exhibit, excuse me, is that 17? The multifamily zone chart that we were looking at before. Yeah, exhibit 17. So that's the current state for summary. Could I also pull up our exhibit number 2? And the purpose for these questions, Mr. Wetland, is just to clarify the difference of when a DNS is conducted versus when a full SEPA EIS was conducted. So if you could pull up exhibit number 2, which I can kind of see. I see the file list, but I don't see the actual document. Yeah. Maybe try resharing it. And while we pull that up, Mr. Rutland, let's go to page 2 under townhouse, row houses, LR1.
Your Honor, I don't know if I should necessarily want to object to this, but I do. Maybe I will make an objection here that what is being shown is a summary of the code requirements that were in place in 2016, which they have all changed, and the existing requirements were are in hearing examiner 17, so I don't know if, you know, what the relevance of showing this summary that shows all of the old historic code requirements will be for this appeal, but and that would be my objection, I suppose.
I can respond if you want.
Yeah, Mr. Moran, if you could.
The relevancy of showing what has happened in the past is to show what the City of Seattle has done before relative to SEPA analysis and what triggered that SEPA analysis to what is being proposed now. Right, we have heard Mr. Rutland testify that we had made a determination of non-significance that was being proposed for relatively minor changes, and we'd like to compare those minor changes to the full FEIS study that was done for the MHA, which is what you...
I'll allow the question for now.
Okay, thank you. So, Abby, if we could just page to the left a little bit so we see the bold, low-rise one terminology. We don't need to see the apartments, I don't think. There we go. Thank you. Mr. Ruffman, can you, in context to this exhibit 17 right now, can you describe what you're seeing in this prior city document that was issued prior to the MHA changes?
Yeah, I'm seeing a summary as it existed before MHA citywide implementation. And I'm seeing that this is one very small slice of what that proposed action did. That proposed action made zoning changes in 27 urban villages across the city. It addressed many more zones in addition to the zones that I'm looking at on the screen. It changed height limits for pretty much every zone, including neighborhood commercial zones, low-rise zones, high-rise zones, mid-rise zones, residential small lot zones. It also expanded, I think, over a dozen urban villages on the City of Seattle's future comprehensive plan land use map.
Okay, thank you. So relative to row houses and townhouses, what do you see as the primary changes in just the row houses and townhouses from what we had before the MHA to what we currently have?
Well, it changed the FAR limit, so the floor area ratio limit row on this chart. It changed the density limit row, changed the height limit row. So those are, among the changes, but those are some of the key ones.
And how did it change the height? Did the height increase from 30 feet in townhouses and row houses?
It did for the low rise 2 and 3 zones. I think it went from 30 feet to 40 feet.
Okay.
And it also changed the height limit for apartments to 50 feet in low-rise 3 and I think 40 feet in low-rise 2.
But it didn't change anything with the, did it change anything with the green factor?
I don't believe it changed the green factor, no.
Or setbacks?
I can't recall if it changed some of the setback requirements.
And a density change?
Yeah, it did substantially change the density limit, including removing the density limit for apartments.
And it went from, for row houses, say, for example, what do you read as the density for row houses prior to the MHA?
I read 1 unit per 1,600 square feet of lot area.
Okay.
Yeah.
And currently it is?
I think it's 1 per 1,350, but I'm Just saying that off the top of my head from memory.
Yeah, we can look at Exhibit 17 to verify that. And it is now being proposed that...
I think it's one per 1,100. Again, without having the number in front of me, I'm just quoting from memory, but it's a reduction to that ballpark.
And we mentioned before with the testimony from Mr. Staley that that basically means about one additional townhouse or row house in a LR1 zone with what's being proposed.
Right, so that's discussed. It says that in the determination where it says that where density of development would be increased, the increase would be on the order of one additional housing unit on the redevelopment of a 5,000 to 6,000 square foot lot. So yes, I agree with your characterization.
Okay. What would have been the density prior to MHA or the townhouses? Going back to the example that we talked about before, where we had a 5,000 square foot lot and prior to the current, where currently you can do three townhouses on that 5,000 square foot lot, if that's what I heard or testified. Is that correct?
Yeah, I heard Mr. Staley's testimony on that, and I agree with his conclusions.
And it would be increased to, was it going to be increased to four for every 5,000 square foot lot? Is that your...
Generalizing, yes, you could do four townhouses instead of three.
Okay.
on that size lot.
And looking at before the MHA changes on townhouses, what's the density limit there, and what would that translate to be for a 5,000 square foot lot?
It says one unit per 2,200 square feet or one unit per 1,600 square feet. I think the difference there is whether or not it's in an urban village.
Let's go to the more liberal number with...
One is 16.
Yeah.
I hate doing math on the fly, so it would be 5,000 divided by 1,600, which I could, if I punched into a calculator, I could do that, but I don't want to do live math. Maybe you could do it for me.
Good. Let me, what number is it punch in?
5,000
divided by 1,600. 3 point something.
5,000 divided by 1,600. It should be 4,800. You got 200 left, so that's 3.2, something like that. Does that sound about right?
3.2, okay.
Right, so that would allow, prior to MHA, that would be three townhouse units on a 5,000 square foot lot.
So really no change in terms of number of dwellings for townhouses before or after the MHA was implemented. It's three now, it was three before MHA. Is that what you're...
Yeah, this particular row of this particular chart, yeah, but you could, at the same time, you were granted, as a developer would have access to greater floor area, you know, so... The density limit didn't change for this item, but other things changed. And,
right.
And also, this is just, again, one very small piece of a vastly bigger proposal.
So in this case, it's a smaller piece of a... If this was standalone on itself, you would have said that there would have been no need to perhaps have a SEPA EIS conducted for just the townhouses and row houses?
Well, we would have prepared a checklist and looked at what the impacts could be based on what that proposal was and prepared a determination for that proposal.
Okay. I think we can stop sharing this. You mentioned, or you talked about technical clarification. One of the reasons I think you testified that a DNS was justified is that there was only technical clarifications of the code being proposed.
Not only, but that was an aspect and a motivation, partial aspect of the proposal.
What's the difference between the proposed changes in the code versus on the bus?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'll just say that the omnibus, the city of Seattle often prepares omnibus legislation roughly once per year, and that legislation does address problems or inconsistencies or errors. Sometimes those are technical in nature. That doesn't mean that other legislation can't fix or address technical elements as well.
Could an omnibus be used for a technical clarification of the code?
It could be, and other legislation such as this legislation could be used for technical corrections of the code.
Was this legislation at one point considered for omnibus?
I don't know that. I don't know if it was or if it wasn't.
Okay. Let's see. Were you part of the interrogatory responses?
I did. Yeah, I was a part of that.
Okay. Do you recall seeing a draft version of the code change, some earlier draft versions of the code change, or was that before your time?
I was present during early drafts. I did not work on earlier drafts of the code changes. I might have some vague knowledge of earlier drafts, but I don't have I don't have a detailed recollection of earlier versions.
Okay. That would have been Mr. Staley, correct?
Yes.
All right. Your Honor, I may have to provide a supplemental description of that because there were some versions of, we received an earlier version during our discovery process that may help to clarify what I was hoping to identify with Mr. Whitland. If that's okay.
You mean a prior draft of earlier versions of the proposed code changes?
Yeah, as an omnibus versus a DNS.
Okay. Just coordinate with Mr. Mitchell on exchanging that, and then if there are any objections or whatnot, I'll rule on those.
Okay. Thank you very much. One other question, I think you testified earlier about combined sewer overflow. For this proposal?
I mentioned that as, one of the types of items that, could factor into level of service for utilities and, could be a signal of, a potential significant impact related to utilities, but I use that as one of the types of examples.
Okay. Do you think that adding additional dwellings within LR zones may have a additional surcharge to the sewer system?
More residences could have an incremental incremental impact to discharges to the sewer system, yes.
Did you hear the prior testimony discussing the area required on the lot for parking?
I did hear that.
Could there be a potential increase in stormwater because of additional impervious surfaces due to this proposal?
Well, I don't think it's conclusory that there would be increased surface area due to parking from this proposal. I heard the testimony earlier. However, if you look at the determination related to parking, you know, it talks about how there could be, depending on a specific development, more or less demand for on-site parking. I think that it would be off base to conclude that across the board that there would be more impervious surface due to parking. It could be, but it's not conclusive that there would be.
Okay. And you've seen conclusive studies, or you have done some conclusive studies in this regard relative to impervious surfaces and parking?
No.
And have you done any conclusive studies in terms of the statement you made earlier about no change in the lot coverage due to the FAR staying the same but the dwelling count increasing?
Well, that is, like, that is clear and evident that the, you know, the standard for amenity area slash open space is not being amended by this code change. So that before and after this proposal, I think it's 25% of lot area has to be provided as amenity area. And the same is true for green factors, that the, you know, the green factor requirement is not changed. So we can say in a conclusory way that those standards will continue to apply on the new development. That doesn't require, you know, detailed technical analysis to be able to conclude that. We can be confident that that's the case.
If there was a study presented to you or reviewed during these hearings that demonstrated otherwise, would the city be inclined to retract their DNS and do a more thorough study?
Let's see. Let me think about that question.
Let me just ask you the question differently. Has a city specifically done a architectural site coverage study to support the theory that additional dwellings will not take up more land area if the FAR is unchanged?
Well, there is the concept that, you know, I wouldn't call it a detailed site study, but the concept diagram that you went through with Mr. Staley that showed the footprint of buildings with three units versus four, you know, it's really not that complicated in the sense that, you know, the total amount of floor area stays the same. The density limit increases so that you have four units instead of three, but the footprint of those four units is the same as the footprint of the three units. That's the most likely, you know, site development concept. So without doing detailed architectural, you know, renderings or site planning, that, you know, basic understanding of how the site would be developed is informative.
So there's a basic understanding, but I'm hearing there has been no study done, right?
Well, that is a study.
A theoretical analysis is like a study in terms of impacts.
Well, you can see it. It has two diagrams. That is a study. And I also, as a, you know, preparer of the determination, have a, you know, drawing, as I said, on understanding of how development typically occurs in the low-rise zones and, you know, what is customary you know, I have a understanding that helps to predict, you know, or have a feel for how a typical site plan would be before and compare that to after the code changes.
Okay. In terms of the building code, what sections of the building code have you used to arrive at the DNS relative to this proposal?
Do you mean the zoning code or the building code?
Zoning code, my apologies.
Yeah, so chapter 20.
I'm sorry, let me rephrase that. Because this is a CEPA determination, what portions of the environmental code, Title 25, have you used?
Well, the procedures, Title 25 lays out the procedures, and that's one section that you know, we always use. It also, the Title 25 also has the city's locally adopted CEPA policies, so we're referring to and drawing on those, as well as the thresholds for CEPA review. I was drawing on those as well. So really the entirety of the chapter 25. It, you know, I don't have all of chapter 25 memorized, but, you know, we drew on, for any CEPA determination, you're drawing on that chapter extensively.
And can you elaborate on the non-project actions, how you viewed the non-project action relative to this proposal?
Yeah, well, that's a very important aspect of this proposal. You know, non-project action is an action for which, you know, there's no construction proposed, there's no physical alteration of the environment that is occurring due to this proposal. This proposal changes the regulations. So it may have indirect impacts in the future based on how it would change the character of future development under the changed code, but there's no direct impact to the physical actual world directly from this proposal, and that's why it's a non-project action as opposed to a project action.
But is there not results to the environment from projects that result out of this decision?
Right, and those are the indirect impacts that are discussed in the checklist as well as the determination.
Pull up exhibit number 16. I'm pulling up Sale Municipal Code, Chapter 2505, 670, Cumulative Effects Policy. Is it your understanding, Ms. Rutland, that there's no, or are there cumulative effects due to this proposed policy?
There could be. We reviewed and considered whether there might be cumulative effects.
And if we page down to to the next page, I'm sorry, under policies, there we go. Would you mind reading from line number 1, point 8?
Starting at number 1?
Yeah.
Okay. the analysis of cumulative effects shall include a reasonable assessment of a present planned capacity of such public facilities as sewers, storm drains, solid waste disposal, parks, schools, streets, utilities, and parking areas to serve the area affected by the proposal. B, the present planned public services such as transit, health, police, and fire protection, and social services to the area affected by the proposal. C, the capacity of natural systems such as air, water, light, and land to absorb the direct and reasonably anticipated indirect impacts of the proposal. And D, the demand upon facilities, services, and natural systems present simultaneously and known future development in the area of the project or action.
Thank you. And was it your conclusion that there was cumulative effects from this proposal?
It was my conclusion that to the extent that there were cumulative effects, that they were not probably significant.
Good stuff, Sharon. Thank you. Are you familiar with the state law regarding your role as the CEQA responsible official on this project?
I am familiar with the state law, yes.
And what is the, how does the city designate a CEQA responsible official?
So I believe it, the director may delegate that. The city, depending on the proposal, the city, different city departments have, you know, different CEPA responsible officials. A transportation proposal, for example, will often be a member of the transportation department, where the transportation director would delegate that responsibility to her staff. In this case, my director was, you know, would officially be the responsible official, but it's common for directors to delegate that to staff.
Okay, so the director, what's the director's name? Sorry?
Our acting director's name is Rico Quirindongo.
Okay, and he is, we've asked to have him testify, but understand that that was not necessary because you've been appointed to that role for this particular project.
For this particular action, yes.
What type of training was involved in that as your director transferred that responsibility to you for this project?
You're asking what training was involved?
Yeah, to become the CEPA responsible official as appointed by the director, what training was involved?
Your Honor, I guess I'd just say, chime in here with an objection, only because I don't see how these questions are relevant to any of the issues that the appellants raised in this appeal.
Yeah, I guess I've been wondering the same thing, because I think we're getting a little off track from the actual appeal issues, and I am a little worried given how many witnesses we have to get through.
Okay.
And we've gone through a bit, we went through the credentials earlier and so forth. So.
Okay. Wrapping up some questions, Jeff, then, or Mr. Brennan, I'm sorry. Do you feel that there has been adequate information provided to arrive at the determination of non-significance?
I do. I think the checklist prepared was complete and accurate, and I think there was enough information available in the checklist, other related studies, and I did my own assessment for the determination, and in my view, there was enough information to make this determination of non-significance. I also think that there could be more information prepared, and that's always the case. You can always do more studies, but I think that in this case there was enough information to reasonably determine non-significance.
And you feel the agency has taken a realistic look at the potential hazards or impacts, including the tree canopy, stormwater, and sewer capacity?
Well, I do, and I think when you, you know, read through the determination, it covers all of the elements of the SEPA checklist, all the topic areas, and for each, it's broken into you know, several topical areas, such as land use and development patterns, height, bulk, and scale, noise, light, and glare, housing, etc. And for each of those, it has a discussion, you know, summarizing the types of impacts that would be anticipated. It describes them briefly, and then in each of those subsections, it concludes with a statement as to whether those impacts would be significant or not. And so, you know, yes, I do think there's enough information there in the determination to underpin a determination of non-significance.
And you feel that you have taken a hard look at the environmental impacts that are potential here?
I think that's a vague term. I would repeat what I said earlier, that I think there's enough information to determine non-significance from this proposal.
And that information has all been documented in your SEPA analysis?
And the related studies that, you know, have been cited and discussed in my testimony and Mr. Staley's testimony.
Thank you. No further questions.
Mr. Mitchell, anything further?
I guess I just ask one question, Mr. Rutland. After the answering the questions from Mr. Mooring, do you have anything that further that you'd like to add at this time that you think should be clarified or expanded upon?
Very briefly, I will say that I would expand upon the statement that the sections of the determination where the nature of impacts are summarized, for many of them, or several of them, it's difficult to predict, and it's non-conclusive in terms of whether those impacts would be, you know, greater or lesser. So there are environmental benefits that are described along with potential impacts in some of those sections. And I just emphasize this point because it's difficult to predict over a future time horizon the exact configurations of development, and you know, to do so at times is speculative, and to try to draw conclusions about the environmental impact from speculative information is not what's called on in SEPA. So where, you know, impacts are discussed in the determination where they could be greater or lesser, the reason for that is because without speculating, it can be difficult to predict the exact nature of a development in the future.
Thank you. I don't have any further questions.
Okay, Mr. Maury?
I'm good, thank you.
Okay. All right, thank you for your testimony today, Mr. Wendland. You are dismissed.
Thank you.
So I think the next witness, Mr. Mitchell, you were going to call Mr. Welch, but I'm wondering if we should just take our 15-minute break right now.
That would be fine.
Okay. All right, so it's 3:16. We'll reconvene at 3:31.
Thank you.
We are briefly adjourned.
Recording stopped.